It's an honor for me to be here after Ulrich Genscher's history of why we are here. I'm even more honored. The reason I'm here is to talk about something that I think the high energy computing community has always symbolized. CHEP is a very interesting group, whether as an organization or just as individuals. From the point of view of the computing companies, the computing science community, the high energy physics community has always been the farthest out in advance, the cowboys, the invent it all here because we don't have time to wait for those silly computer people. We'll build our own computers, our own operating systems. We'll put 40 gigaflops in front of every researcher. And the symbolism of Zeuthen, the 10 years ago that the link occurred for the first time from Zeuthen to Dacey, this memory of being in advance of every other institution in linking from East Germany to Western Germany, the experience of CERN being the only link to Beijing. That's the role the high energy physics community has always played: destroy national boundaries or ignore them, and communicate scientific advances. Wait for no one. Spend a lot of money in the process, but wait for no one and move forward, because there, life is short. Now, the reason I'm here is because there's been a change in computing. And this article, which went up yesterday, this morning I got up in the hotel and brought this web page over. 2 days ago, we finished a conference, quite startling conference, in California. 10,000, at the end, almost 12,000 Java programmers were in San Francisco until yesterday or day before. This man, Johnson, did something that's reminded me very much of you in the computing part of high energy physics, going into meetings where no one wants to hear about doing something new and saying to everyone, we are going to fly the Hubble, we are going to run all telemetry, we are going to receive engineering and control data and science data, and we're going to do it with Java. The tension between state of the art and tried and trusted. Now that's the tension you always are in. We are more than state of the art, and yet we have to be completely reliable and tested. Well, those two are conflicting. In this case, with NASA, the man that runs this, the Hubble operation, Friday, standing up giving his talk, he said, what we had to do with data collection, scientific data collection, was to provide the scientific community with analytic tools that would run on everything. They'll run on DEC, they'll run on Sun, they'll run on Silicon Graphics, they'll run on PCs, they'll run on Macintosh, because we're tired in the scientific community of having the first question asked of us by the science analysts when told there's an analytic program: what does it run on? The answer always is something that you don't have. You know, if you have this, it runs on that. So what Johnson did at NASA was to take the redo of the entire system, 1980-1981 software, redo it in a way that was machine and operating system independent. So that's what Java is. And I'm going to talk a bit about why Java has characteristics that are interesting to Johnson and to CHEP. Why is this interesting to you? And this text here of Johnson's comments He just was wandering the web, discovered the Java applets, began to write code, state-of-the-art tools, but mature. And he showed Friday real-time telemetry. There was a launch on Friday, and we watched the 7,000 state variables coming down from Hubble, going to TDRS, the satellite communication system, coming down in Texas, going to Jet Propulsion Lab, coming on the internet to this large auditorium in San Francisco. We watched real-time telemetry, and so should every scientific user of these gigantic devices that you build. Every bit of detection software, every bit of data, every bit of analysis should be available, not just to you, but to everyone. And for the first time, this is beginning to become possible. So this is Johnson's comment. These web pages, or I'll give you the addresses later, his discussion talked about how they ran, what they did. And the final comment from NASA Goddard Space Flight Center was the comment made by the overall Goddard management that considered Johnson's Java-based software to be the most successful control center software system ever installed. I think that's from several points of view. One point of view is it can be maintained and it runs on everything. So what I wanted to talk to you a bit about today is a change from what used to be simply the province of the rich, that's us, using the internet, which for the first time in the last 3 years has become ubiquitous with protocols that run on all machines. This PC runs TCP/IP. Unthinkable a few years ago. Everything now allows us to share data and share analysis. I went to a meeting in Washington a week or so ago. This man, who was the head of Citicorp, he created much of the modern banking system, said, you know, from my point of view, this is a 75-year-old eminent person, from my point of view, said Wriston, we're changing the economic structures of society with internet. The elements of the balance of power are shifting. And in the world of communication, the internet standard is more draconian than the gold standard. A rumor of one small change in policy, the world economic parameters shift. The prices every moment are being recalculated. $1 trillion a day is traded in New York based upon information coming across the internet. We're seeing an enormous underlying alteration in power systems. The opening of this building to free scientific discourse is a playing out in some way of the opening of information systems. So I thought, even though it's early in the morning, I would use a quote from Isaiah Berlin. He wrote a book called Recollections of a Historian of Ideas. And his discussion of philosophy, I think, affects how we think about what we do. He said, philosophy comes from the collision of ideas, which create problems. Ideas come from life. Life changes. So do the ideas, so do the collisions. The collisions breed puzzles, but when life changes, these puzzles are not so much answered as die away. Ideas perish from inanition far more frequently than as a result of being refuted by argument. We're in that moment now in technology. There's no refutation of those old computing structures. They're just dying away. The presence of 12,000 Java programmers in San Francisco is an indication of the need inherent in the computing community to move away from the old structures and try something that runs ubiquitously on everything. We are not going to argue against the old codes. We're not going to discuss whether the NAG algorithms are accurate here or not there. We're going to simply move forward in bringing a new kind of computing. It's based upon the network. Now, I will skip the arguments about language, which I'll just use this. There's one quote here. To understand what we're doing, human beings use metaphor. Ulrich Genscht used several in his discussion of the move from the old site to this site. Rorty, who's an American philosopher, says the way we must think about talking about things, about language, is as Darwin taught us to think of the history of a coral reef. Old metaphors die off into literalness. They become hard. They remain in our minds. The metaphor, the way of describing what we're doing, becomes the most powerful way of conveying shortly, instantly, new ideas. So I have a few illustrations from the computing world of that idea. And first, I want to quote my boss, Bill Joy, who says that this moment in computing history is a moment when new metaphors are being created. A technical discontinuity, Joy calls it. We've been building systems of computers for 25 years, says Joy, from a common set of concepts, but now most of the concepts are changing and at the same time. It's a major shift based on, and he uses this word, net-centric programs. That is, the assumption the network is everywhere. We don't. If you truly think of a net-centric constellation of hundreds of millions of machines, now possible for the first time, because at this moment there are 100 million computers running Java virtual machines. That's the sum across all browsers. That's the AS400. That's the MVS systems, the VM systems, the VMS systems. And it's currently the large volume, the new television sets, the Nokia 9000 cellular telephone, all identically running a Java virtual machine, which means every program written can then run on this constellation of different machines. Something new is happening. And our goal, which I'll talk about in a moment, is to take the existing world of computing as we know it, with operating systems such as Unix or NT, all of them state-of-the-art 1985, and move to something new that allows distributed processing and sharing of resources in a way analogous to the thinking in the past that a process in a machine and inter-process communication and some communication across a network with remote procedure call. We move to a new world where the analog to process in a computer is the virtual machine, which brings an enormous number of more powerful concepts to play, among them security. So Joy's statement that we're making a major shift in computing is enabled by the advent of high-speed networking. The meeting yesterday discussed this. The advent of ubiquitous software that allows us to have a common environment. He likens it to the change in 1980, 1981 to microprocessors. And to give a sense of what he means by that, all of us are old enough to think back to 1980 and imagine in 1980 that you are making a list of the 10 major computer companies in 1990. Do this list at, say, 1982. Who is a big computer company or telecommunications company in 1992? IBM, that's a good bet. DEC, good bet. Siemens, Fujitsu, Bull, okay, probably Wang, Data General, Burroughs, Sperry, there is no Unisys. That list in 1982 would not include Microsoft, Sun, Compaq, Novell, Apple, all brought about by a discontinuity, the microprocessor. Big change. Now, 1997, name the companies 5 years from now. How about the one that writes this software? Netscape, No one heard of Netscape except at the Supercomputer Center at Illinois, where Mark Andreas and a graduate student spent a couple of weekends hacking 20,000 lines of code to create Mosaic. Mark's now $400 million in his jean pocket, graduate student, still wearing the same jeans. He hasn't had time enough to buy anything new. He just created a metaphor for reading and writing on the network. The same metaphor the entire high-energy physics community has been searching for forever. How do we link in a civilized way the High Energy Physics Institute in Beijing with CERN and allow people to annotate papers and examine the common data collection? How do we manage to control experiments remotely? We need to have a metaphor for that. If you look at the inventions in the computer world of metaphors, try the first one, this one, the computer's a desktop. That was first demonstrated 1968, Doug Engelbart in front of a crowd of about 2,000 people at the IEEE ACM conference in San Francisco. Engelbart invented the mouse, and on a large screen, a little smaller than this, Engelbart showed windows, icons, select and operate syntax, the things we take for granted 30 years ago. All we've done for 30 years in the computer industry is elaborate that metaphor. Well, there's a second metaphor, which you're very familiar with. The new version of this, the desktop, is a book. That's the Mark Andreas and Tim Berners-Lee, CERN, Ted Nelson first wrote about this in 71. Everything links. That's footnotes, annotation, index, the mechanism of scholarly research. Refereed papers are nothing but links, annotations to past work. Now we have a way to make this real, imminent. We can see the links and follow them. That's the power of the web. That's a powerful metaphor. Here's another one, Ivan Sutherland. PhD thesis with the title Sketchpad. So what's the metaphor? The computer is a sketchpad. 1963. Suddenly everybody said, I understand that. I know that if I draw a line, my hand will shake, so the computer will let me draw a straight line. And I can put physics into the straight line. It can be a copper trace on a circuit board. I know resistance, I know heat. I can determine how much current can pass through that circuit. I can have an intelligent sketch pad that tells me how wide to make the trace so it won't burn up when I apply certain current to it. So that simple idea that Sutherland created a program at MIT to run was the foundation, that metaphor was the foundation for computer-aided design. The machine can help us. They can examine the physics of something that we draw. He also talked about flying into the heart of stars, examining chromosomal links, which I'll show you. I'm not on the net, so I may not be able to, but I'll give you a citation that is last week's wonderful innovation in flying through the genome projects that allow you to visualize gene sequences in a web page with Java programs running. That's the nicest way to look at that kind of data for the biological community, freely available. In any case, that metaphor of Sutherland's 36 years later, 34 years later, is the basis for much of what we do in design work. Here's one the intelligence agencies like. You get to look down on everyone, take pictures, figure out where everyone is, and then kill them. And if you want to know exactly how to kill them, you command all the entities scattered around in your warfare operation. You have a command and control. Well, we have all of these and all of the accelerators. This is the new model, the new metaphor. This is science as it's performed. You know, the model of a scientist, there's a black box and talks and papers and coffee go in and talks and papers come out, probably other things. So the conversation which is the heart of science, is now suddenly a broader conversation. It can be brought into your child's classroom. And that's the most exciting part, I think, about what this 10-year period from Zeuthen's link to DAISY, 10 years, only 10 years ago, the first link, we're now at an explosion where everything is linked. So just to give a sense of the links, I made a listing of where the hosts are around the world. You can see there are a lot, probably more than this in the US, but the numbers now are not just European and US numbers. Australia, Finland, the most highly connected country in the world, Netherlands, France is improving remarkably in spite of great structural resistance to getting the internet throughout France. The Scandinavian countries are deeply networked. We sometimes think that's because in the dark months there's not much else to do. But you can see that suddenly we're seeing new countries, Brazil, South Korea, well, Russian numbers are quite unreliable, Mexico, and South American countries are beginning to be on the net in quite startling numbers. And this is 2 months ago, so the numbers have increased by about, we're at a rate of about 300% growth a year in these host numbers. So it brings me to the switch we're in the middle of. The last 30 years of technology have simply been exploring the same metaphors, but using cheaper and cheaper processors, cheap memory, cheap disks, an assumption that switches are expensive. The phone switches are $10 or $15 million. Not true anymore. Andy Bechtolsheim, the first employee of Sun, the chief engineer that built things, left Sun, still stayed in the buildings, and built in a box about the size of that a 16 by 16 gigabit Ethernet switch. Cisco just bought Andy and his eight other people for $250 million to make little switches like this. 16 by 16 gigabit switches each pathway, that's a lot of bandwidth in the box, means that what we consider the current means of moving data around the accelerators, it's taken a change. We have cheap switches. So the last 30 years we've been expanding network connectivity. We've had a little technology, remote procedure calls began to work across machines. You've built embedded processors. You've built real-time applications. You've made them by hand, tuned them by hand, and then hoped someone else could get some software to work on them. But since they were all different systems, it was enormously difficult. Suddenly, we're changing all of these assumptions. We end up right now with 150 million machines around the world, 100 million sold each year, that have been disconnected. They've been running the desktop metaphor, that's all. They've not really had a feeling of sharing things. We're in a world where half the people in the world will never make a phone call, and only a few rich people have processors. What happens next is all based on the implications of networks. Ubiquitous software running on all computers, hence the title of the talk, Java. Now, I'll go, the ephemeral hardware means that this machine I have, I'll throw away or lose in the next year, and I'll have a different computer. These computers vanish, but the protocols live on. The processors will be faster, but we're getting to a point where we call it Moore's second law. Each time you decrease the width of the line in VLSI fabrication, you exponentially increase the cost of the fab. We're now at 0.35 micron, requiring $4 billion to build a fabrication plant. This is expensive. We're reaching a point, we're not even into electron tunneling problems. At 0.1 micron, we're putting more money into the fab than we have. So there's a point of decrease. CMOS runs out of gas at some point. Although we've said that before and been wrong, we're at a point where something will happen in 2000, 2005 to shift what kind of computing we do. We do have terabit networks You can run a terabit down fiber. We have megabit wireless today accessible. We can take your existing copper and run a megabit across your own home telephone line with a little box. $6 chipset for HDSL now runs 1.5 megabits for 3,000 meters. We're at a point where we have a shift underneath that continues in the hardware. I've held in my hand polymer storage, terabyte storage on a credit card sized device. It's changing the assumptions about where we put things and how much it costs. What's going to come next, as we have these machines worldwide that all have the same standards, is an explosion of new companies becoming involved. We count computer companies, IBM, Apple, DEC, HP, those are computer companies. The Alcatels are sort of also computer companies. What we're seeing now, and what we saw on Friday and Thursday in San Francisco, are the other computer companies. Siemens with the smart card running the Java virtual machine. Sony, Toshiba, Philips, the consumer electronics companies putting memory and processing power in each device they sell at a $300 price point. We're seeing something different emerging, a new kind of decentralized processing. So let me show you some, I suppose overall, the survey idea would be that we don't care about Sun or Intel or Microsoft. They don't matter. It's the network that matters. It's the protocols that run across all machines, protocols that run across all operating systems with software distributed everywhere. Now, let me take you one level more into what's going to happen with software. We're going to change software because these computers aren't built properly. What will happen in this new world of ubiquitous applets? Applications made of objects come across the wire and meet for the first time, which means static optimization doesn't work. Doesn't make any sense. There's no way to analyze either the structure of the microprocessor or the way the software works with other software because it has been combined in a new way for the first time, which means look-aside tables, all the techniques you use for building today's computer architectures don't work very well. We're doing dynamic assembly of component software. Now, at the hardware side, we're building, and so are 15 hardware companies, little chips that execute bytecodes directly. They're going to be fast. They're going to be very low power. They're going to be cheap. For the high speed, for you who need the maximum amount of computational power, we're going to focus on dynamic optimization of code. These are at research level problems. So our next generation of applications, first the good part, they're machine independent. They begin to be testable. We've not had that in the past. The structure of Java forces you to declare exceptions. Anything that goes wrong, you must declare. So we can begin to test software elements to see if they function. None of this loose stuff that we've been writing for years where the machine crashes and there's no way to tell why. Removing, for example, pointer arithmetic is a fundamental step in that. You can't force programmers, as C does, to allocate memory. Human beings make one-off errors, indetectable in 10 million runnings of the code, because when you're off by one in an array space in memory, it doesn't land on anything that crashes the machine. The 10 million and first time it does, and you can't recreate the system. It's non-deterministic. So the goal is to move from indeterminate systems to determinate. And that was a major component of the development of the Java language. So our focus for the next 5 years in this evolution of the Java environment is to make it safe and testable, to have static and dynamic checking, to allow concurrency. We've kept it very simple, just monitors. We have four concurrency mechanisms at the moment in Java, to allow concurrency to take advantage of this new world of ubiquitous common networking protocols and ubiquitous common virtual machines. Now, you all know the specifications of Java, and you've read. Now, those of you that are computer science people may have tackled chapter 19 in the Java language specification. This is the LALR1 abstract syntax, the syntax analysis, so you specify the language so you can be determinate. I have not tackled it because I can't read it. Only Bill Joy and Guy Steele, I think, are at the level of being able to read it. But there are probably 20 people in the world that need to know that level of specificity. But that was the level of effort we put into creating a language that could be analyzed. Now, what's strange about all this? Another title for Let's Create Java is Let's Spend 3 Years in a lot of fights. So the ML community, the Smalltalk community, the Oberon community, the Self community, each of the language groups has solved certain problems in computer languages and knows that God spoke to them and they've seen their way clearly through this, which results in a design situation with 5 people that I call 125 votes. What do we do about parameterized types? This is a very complicated question. And Gosling's on one side, and Joy's on the other, and they have fights that are essentially, to be fair, screaming matches about this. And we would never present this in a public forum, but it's how things evolve in describing the language. So we went through these issues in front of 10,000 people on Thursday, and listed 9 areas where, how do we do the order of evaluation? How are we building the parallelism and memory model? What are we doing in specifying the next changes to Java? What are we doing about floating point? For those of you that know Velu Khan and the deficiencies of Cray floating point that he's pointed out over the years, Khan at Berkeley is immersed in the next round of definition of IEEE 754. How do we evolve the floating point spec, and how does Java take care of all floating point exceptions in an advanced way? We have a big argument at this moment about interval arithmetic. Khan, of course, says Wolfram and physicists in general don't understand arithmetic. So there's a wonderful fight to get into. How do we specify this properly in the language so you feel comfortable? And Khan will never feel comfortable, but you know, at least he'll be less irritated than he is today about how these things work. So we're at the presence right now, and I'll just to give you pointers about how you can be involved in this. As you have opinions, the person that's guided the intellectual development of this is Guy Steele. For those of you that bought the Connection Machine, Guy was in charge at Thinking Machines of all the parallelizing compiler work, all the efforts to allow the language to take care of parallelizing issues. He, of course, wrote the Fortran and the C and the Common Lisp language specifications. So without Guy, there would not be a Java specification. He's the person with the proper kind of intellect to bring together a language specification that can live. And he's the first to acknowledge which of these 125 votes could have gone one way or the other. So guy.steele@sun.com or bill.joy@sun.com or james.gosling@sun.com, they're the critical people in the definition of the evolution of which direction the Java language takes. Now, I won't go through garbage collection and the long-term implications of how important that is. That's the Lisp community speaking. That's Guy Steele, who created Scheme with Jerry Sussman. It's an idea of making a simple language. But inside the machine architecture are some interesting applications. If we do static optimizations today, and the future applications are dynamic, we don't have a grip on the metrics adequate to measuring how well things are going. We've been doing spec market optimizations. They don't matter anymore. we're going to see a change in instruction mixes, in address traces, in branch distributions based on this new kind of code. This is new territory. This is new arena for optimizations. We have to do runtime optimization. Now, I think I'll switch from this presentation into Friday's update on what's going on inside Java. I have 17 minutes to do this. Let me make sure I'm right on my time. No, I don't. I have 3 minutes to do this. All right, so, All right, we're going to go quickly here. All right, we know we want to make things parallel. So let's find the slide that will show us what I want to show. This is a physical chart that Addison Wesley makes showing the existing class libraries. The discussions, and there were three technical tracks with 5 to 10 sessions each, all on the network, which is an interesting new thing for conferences. As a conference would be given, as a presentation would be given, transcripts went up on the net. So you can find the transcripts at www.javasoft.com of the keynotes, the slides for the presentation, the transcripts of the presentation, and a variety of pointers from them into deeper things. Here, we went through each of the class libraries and detailed the different work going on to bring new interfaces forward. So these are classes that do things, arithmetic and a number of other things. And this page, the Java API list, shows in 20 areas the newest API definitions, and this is where you should pay attention, because the Java Development Kit incorporates a lot of internationalization, but the Java beans, these are components that can be written by anyone and brought into your application to use, the 2D and 3D APIs, and I have brought with me for you, it's all right, but for the commercial world, a restricted specification. The demonstrations 2 days ago of the Java two-dimensional API, which was work done by Intel, Adobe, Sun, Silicon Graphics, Microsoft, and Apple, and essentially the same group with the Java 3D, describe how all representation of scenes, static scenes, dynamic scenes, the VRML stuff you've seen, that's all dead now. This is a way to be able to represent graphically all 2D and 3D with classes written by those whose business it is to do this and use it. If they're not good enough, then you get to complain to Silicon Graphics or Sun or Adobe or any of the idiots that, I mean, our group that's worked on it. But these specs and their implementations are now up and going out on the net, which means that I think there's a moment now that the work being done in Java can reinforce your work. It's an area in which you can now build upon things that have been put together by tens of thousands of programmers that you can then turn into the scientific visualizations and the networking and collaborative work that you're building as the primary agenda of CHEP 97. And with that, I think I'll stop. Thank you very much.